This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 16, 2003. From WBAI in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi. Iraqi women discuss what kind of interim government they want. Student protests continue to rock Iran. The Supreme Court rules to limit the government's ability to force criminal defendants to take antipsychotic medicines. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Jackson Allers with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. By today's end, the last 13 of 46 black residents of Tulia, Texas, wrongly indicted, arrested, or convicted in a fabricated drug sting, are scheduled to be released in the same courtroom they faced 4 years ago. Robert Knight reports from Tulia, Texas.
In a breathtaking legal slap at the local sheriff, prosecutor, and a since-indicted undercover police agent named Tom Coleman, the remaining detainees will have their bail posted by the state of Texas, pursuant to new legislation intended to repudiate the malicious prosecution. Earlier Monday, the 13 were marched in handcuffs from a Texas state prison van to meet with lawyers, suppressing smiles but withholding substantive comment till they were finally free of their chains and incarceration. But others have not been silent about the case, which locked up more than half of Tulia's African-American wage earners, including the lead attorney in the case, Jeff Blackburn of Amarillo, who says today's symbolic victory is not enough and will litigate for full pardons for the defendants and their families at the Swisher County Courthouse in Tulia, Texas. I'm Robert Knight for Free Speech Radio News.
25,000 unionized General Electric employees have a tentative new contract today. John Hamilton of the Workers' Independent News Service has more.
The coalition of GE unions struck the deal hours before their old contract was set to expire at 12:01 this morning, averting a strike that could have followed as early as June 26th. Bill Roundsville of IUECWA Local 201 helped win the contract. He says a two-day strike of union General Electric employees last January helped pressure the company into settling.
You know, I think it really fired people up. We feel really determined that we're not going to accept a bad contract from this company. Our membership is really steeled. Certainly the strike in January helped get them ready.
While union leaders won't yet comment on details of the agreement, they say the deal helps safeguard affordable health care while substantially increasing employee pensions. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
Some members of Congress are challenging last month's FCC ruling to weaken media ownership rules. James Cullum reports from Washington, D.C.
The effort to roll back the FCC's decision is being headed by Republicans and Democrats. Senator John McCain, chairman of the committee, says that he is against the rollback to 35%, but he believes it will pass in the committee. John Schwartz, president of Free Speech TV, questions whether Congress is all bark and no bite, or if the FCC will be seriously threatened for the loosening of ownership limits.
Whether this passes through the Congress or not will be the acid test as to whether this is just Republican posturing or whether there really is a bipartisan consensus in Congress that media consolidation has gone too far.
Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan is trying to eliminate cross-ownership rules altogether, rules which say that a television mogul like Rupert Murdoch can buy not only a number of television networks, but also newspaper bureaus and radio stations in the same city. Dorgan's legislation is not expected to pass. However, he says that if necessary, he'll seek the Congressional Review Act, which would allow Congress to review the FCC's new ownership rules and then decide on whether or not to keep the current regulations. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
In Amman, Jordan, a Japanese journalist who accidentally killed a Jordanian airport officer on May 1st is getting a special royal pardon. Ula Farawati in Amman has more.
Jordan's King Abdullah has pardoned a Japanese journalist who was jailed after a souvenir cluster bomb he was carrying blew up and killed a Jordanian airport security guard early in May. Jordan State Security Court sentenced Hiroki Gomi this month to a reduced 18-month sentence after dropping charges of possession of explosives, an offense punishable by up to 15 years. 20% of Jordan's $7 billion foreign debt is owed to Japan, also a major donor country for the cash-strapped kingdom. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
On Saturday, Korean Americans from Metro D.C. held a candlelight vigil in front of the White House to commemorate the first anniversary of the death of two South Korean schoolgirls killed by a U.S. military vehicle. Ingrid Drake reports from Washington.
South Koreans were horrified when the American soldiers involved in the crime were acquitted in a U.S. military court and not subject to prosecution by South Korean authorities. Kia Sao from the Coalition of Korean Americans for Peace and Justice says the U.S. presence in South Korea is a major factor for the tensions with North Korea.
Koreans already negotiated the non-aggression agreement and economic relationship, but because U.S. troop is still there, it's a stumbling block. I mean, all the foreign forces have left Korea. You know, China and Russia no longer have that kind of deep vested interest except the U.S. So we want the U.S. to reassess that situation and let Koreans decide their own destiny.
The demonstrators carried signs calling for the reform of the status of forces agreement between South Korea and the U.S. military. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake reporting.
And for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jackson Allers.
In Tehran, for the past 6 nights in a row, Iranian students have taken to the streets to protest against the present government, demanding for more civil freedoms. The United States again has endorsed anti-government protests in Iran after Tehran accused Washington of meddling in its domestic affairs. Pejman Haghighi has more.
On June 3rd, 14 years after his death, the voice of the charismatic late Ayatollah Khomeini still resonates. During the week-long ceremonies commemorating Khomeini's death, Iran's state-run radio and television carried his voice through the airwaves. Just like he did in 1979, Khomeini's voice urged the masses to safeguard Islam and the Islamic Republic. This time, Khomeini's message didn't take. Just 2 weeks after the anniversary of his death, hundreds of Iranian students started a week-long demonstration to demand an end to the strict Islamic regime now overseen by Khomeini's successor Ayatollah Khamenei. After witnessing 6 nights of protest, Mahnaz, a student and reporter in Tehran, says the demonstrations began after the government proposed tuition hikes at one of the nation's top universities, but the demonstrations soon took a life of their own.
The first night, it was just students at Amir Kabir University complaining about tuition hikes. But because everyone is so frustrated with the government, it became more than just a student demonstration. Students demonstrated 4 years ago, but this time around, they don't trust President Khatami to change anything. They just want an end to the whole regime.
Iranians' frustration stems from the strict Islamic laws that came into place after the revolution. Reformist President Khatami's election in 1997 was a turning point for young Iranians, giving them hope for more freedom and better economic opportunities. However, political power in Iran is split between the elected leadership and the hardline judiciary and the Council of Clerics, who are appointed by the supreme leader. The hardliners have made it very difficult for President Khatami to push for reform. Mahnaz, a 45-year-old mother of two living in Tehran, says the young people have the right to be frustrated.
There's no personal freedom in Iran, especially for young people. My 20-year-old daughters can't go out without being harassed about their appearance by the religious fundamentalists. I'm religious and I can tolerate Islamic restrictions, but I fully understand and support the younger generation in their frustrations. This regime has erased any religious tendencies the youth may have once had.
U.S. threats against Iran have grown louder over the last 2 months. As a result, hardliners have gained ground against the reformists. Since the end of the war on Iraq, the Bush administration has accused Iran repeatedly of supporting terrorism and building weapons of mass destruction. Bush has also expressed support for the recent student movement. This is playing right into the hands of hardliners, allowing them to accuse the U.S. of being an enemy of Islam and to silence the reformists. In a speech in the city of Aramin Thursday, Iran's spiritual leader Ayatollah Khamenei accused the U.S. of orchestrating the riots.
America is planting the seeds of unrest. Our nation and our government, and especially our youth, should be aware of this. I call on you to unite. I call on our government to be diligent and resolve our real domestic issues.
Iranians are locked in a paradox. On the one hand, they want more personal freedom. They want change, whether it comes from within or whether it takes an outside force like the U.S. to bring it about. At the same time, Iranians cannot forget the bitter memory of American intervention in Iran that started with the CIA-backed coup in 1953. Again, Maryam.
Despite what your American audience might think, Iranians are not welcoming America's help with open arms. It's true that young people have gone through extreme hardship in the last 20 years, but what they want now is not impossible. It does not require American intervention. Iranians have a short historical memory, but the young educated ones that will be our future leaders won't forget the 1953 coup. That's when they took down the most popular government in Iranian history.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pejman Hariri with Carolina Braunschweig.
The Supreme Court ruled today by 6-3 to limit the government's ability to force criminal defendants to take antipsychotic medicine that will make them competent to stand trial. In another vote of 7-2, the court ruled that the right to free speech does not trump Congress's goal of limiting what it called the corrosive effects of corporate money in politics. Josh Chaffin reports from the Supreme Court.
The first Supreme Court decision this morning has been cast as a prelude to the pending fight over the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. That case is about interest groups spending for political advertising and how late before an election groups should be allowed to advertise. In today's decision, the court maintained it's illegal for a North Carolina anti-abortion group, or any corporate entity, to give money directly from their treasury to a candidate for office. Larry Noble maintains a comprehensive money in politics database as president of the Center for Responsive Politics.
Now, the real game is in the Supreme Court right now with the McCain-Feingold law, because that has the far broader restrictions on what the so-called issue groups can do with the type of ads that they can take out, whether they can attack candidates or name a candidate right before an election. And that's really the big game that everybody's looking towards.
A spokesman for the campaign finance reform group Common Cause says the 7-2 decision bodes well for the McCain-Feingold law, which will be challenged in the Supreme Court in September. Dozens of interest groups are opposing the limits on political speech in that law, including the National Rifle Association and the Christian Coalition, as well as the Democratic and Republican parties and the ACLU. The ACLU's Stephen Shapiro says today's case doesn't necessarily have ramifications for the McCain-Feingold case.
The heart of McCain-Feingold, at least from our point of view, is its restriction on the ability of groups like the ACLU to engage in core political speech, not contributions to candidates or campaigns, but core political speech on our own behalf.
The Supreme Court's second ruling today was hailed by civil rights groups, trial lawyers, and some doctors' groups. It'll keep federal authorities from drugging a St. Louis dentist named Charles Sell in order to make him competent to stand trial for insurance fraud. Dr. Sell once spit on a judge in court, but he argues he is competent and that the drugs the feds want him to take could hurt him. The Supreme Court ruled today that the prosecutors must try less invasive options before resorting to drugs. At the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, Dr. Jane Orient could think of several options.
You could not put him in a tiny cage in solitary confinement for months and months on end. You could try some other types of treatment that might well restore him to competence. And actually, you might actually evaluate him independently to find out whether he's competent or not. He's passed a written exam that showed him competent. The standards for competence are really very low, and we just have the word of his jailers that he's not competent to stand trial.
The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons had filed a brief on Dr. Sell's behalf, arguing he's already been in jail for longer than he would have had to serve if he were found guilty. Some of Sell's friends believe there's a government conspiracy to keep him out of court for fear that he may talk about his experiences in Waco, Texas, in the infamous Branch Davidian debacle. Dr. Jane Orient again.
They sent him to Waco before the fire as a member of the Army Reserves because of his skills in forensic dentistry. He used forensic dentists to identify bodies who have been burned beyond recognition, and he claims that he knows that the FBI set the fire. Well, you know, who's going to believe him? But anyway, he has made that assertion.
In the next 2 weeks, the Supreme Court will decide if the Texas sodomy law is constitutional. The High Court will also make a ruling in the landmark University of Michigan affirmative action case. Josh Chaffin in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
Conservative activists in California claim that they are on the verge of a revolution by ousting current Governor Gray Davis. They say they have gathered over half of the million signatures necessary to allow voters to decide whether or not to end Davis's term 3 years early. A recent poll suggests that Davis has the lowest approval rating in state history, but women's rights groups oppose the recall. They say the recall's backers, including California Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who has put over $500,000 to the report, are intent to follow a national trend of restricting a woman's right to an abortion. Mitch Jeserich reports from Sacramento.
According to the field poll, Gray Davis is the least popular governor in California history, and the poll suggests that half of Californians would vote to recall Davis, boosting him out of office just after winning re-election last November. Though the recall is being pushed by the state's right-wing conservative forces, Davis has found Democratic and liberal support tepid at best, possibly due to the appearance that large campaign contributions influence his policy decisions and comments like this one.
My parents are Republicans. My in-laws are conservative Republicans, so I have a few conservative genes inside of me. I just want to say that for the record.
Listening to right-wing talk radio in Sacramento, as this reporter frequently does, it becomes clear that many people who favor the recall also favor abolishing abortion. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa has put in $800,000 of his own money to the effort and announced that if the recall lands on the ballot, he would run for governor. Both the National Organization of Women and Planned Parenthood are backing Gray Davis because Issa has indicated in the past that he supports abolishing abortion. Megan Seeley, the president of California Now, says the current attack on Davis, who has been a staunch supporter of a woman's right to choose, is part of a national Republican campaign against women's right to an abortion.
When we look at the threat, the growing threat of this recall of Governor Gray Davis, what that opens up to is a governor who doesn't support women-centered health care, women's health care at all, particularly things like reproductive health care and abortion rights. And we know when you look on a federal level, when we look at opponents to abortion care, we're also looking at the very same people who do not support contraceptive care, who don't support sex education or empowerment through knowledge for any woman or girl for that matter. We also are looking at people who don't support social services, education programs. I mean, it is comprehensive. It's not just these are the folks who don't support abortion. These are the folks who don't support women, and that's the problem.
Congressman Issa also supported ending affirmative action and Proposition 187, a 1994 voter-passed anti-immigration initiative that would have kicked undocumented children out of the public schools. A spokesperson for the recall group Rescue California, Dave Gilliard, deflected all questions concerning abortion.
From a recall standpoint, is that this election's about Gray Davis's mismanagement of the state finances and a $38 billion deficit and tax increases across the board, and that's why he's being recalled. This recall isn't about abortion. It's not about anything else. As much as some people would like to make it about something else, they'll never be able to change the focus away from Gray Davis's performance in office.
The recall is not the only thing worrying Davis. The state legislature has made no progress in budget negotiations to deal with a $38 billion deficit. Though former Republican governors Ronald Reagan and Pete Wilson raised taxes during tough economic times, legislative Republicans will not give Davis the necessary votes to raise taxes now. A prolonged budget stalemate could drop Davis' approval rating even lower, thus galvanizing the recall campaign. Republican Assemblymember John Campbell is a party leader on budgetary issues. He has also donated $10,000 to the recall campaign. Free Speech Radio News asked Campbell if he and other Republicans were stalling on the budget in order to throw Davis out of office.
I can tell you absolutely unequivocally and with no hesitation or wavering whatsoever that we have no interest in doing that at all.
If the recall supporters get the necessary 897,000 valid signatures by mid-July, anything can happen. Former Green Party gubernatorial candidate Peter Camejo, who received 5% of the vote in the last election, said a recall gives an opportunity to a third-party candidate to win the governorship. The California Green Party does not support the recall, however, and several local chapters vehemently oppose it because of the right-wing radicals who are behind it. Speculation is percolating that Arnold Schwarzenegger will run for governor as a Republican. He will announce his decision after the release of his summer movie, Terminator 3. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Sacramento.
In an embarrassing twist for the US and UK governments this weekend, biological experts working for the British government have concluded that two trailers found in northern Iraq did not make germs for biological warfare, but gas for balloons. Adnan Pachachi, a former Iraqi foreign minister who returned to Iraq last month after more than 30 years of exile, criticised the US military on Saturday for its increasingly aggressive operations in Iraq, stating that they should be suspended until the interim Iraqi government is formed. Meanwhile, women's group in Iraq are showing concern that religious and political groups who have organized into a political force in Iraq may infringe on women's rights should it get into power. Fariba Nawar reports.
Women in Baghdad are anticipating the formation of an Iraqi government nervously. They say they are glad the Ba'athist regime has fallen. They suffered alongside their men, even though women made up 40% of the military and shared equal pay in the workplace. But now, whoever fills the leadership void could either advance their status or subjugate them. So many women are speaking up for what they want. Rahbiya Muhammad Latif, from the Iraqi Women's League, a social and political organization that secretly operated during Saddam Hussein's regime, wants a secular state in which religion and politics are completely separate.
We are demanding that security be preserved. We are looking for and finding those who were executed and jailed during the dictatorship. And we are demanding a women's conference to deal with women's and children's rights.
Latif, 61, can now admit openly that she's a communist. She was jailed when she was 21 and tortured for 6 years for her connection to the Communist Party. For the first time after 35 years, the Iraqi Communist Party gathered to celebrate the end of the dictatorship. Latif sat in the audience crying as she listened to Iraqi folk singer Hassan Breesom sing a song written in Hussein's prisons.
There was hanging upside down from the electric fan. There was beating by thick cables. There was torture by electric shocks and fingernail extractions.
Latif insists that the only way to avoid another dictatorship is to elect a pluralistic government representing all religions and ethnic groups in Iraq. But many women do not share Latif's desire for a secular state. Umma Firas, the mother of four children, is a housewife. She and her women neighbors, who all wear the Islamic headdress, often gather and debate politics.
I prefer an Islamic government because crimes will be less. People will be afraid of God and behave well and will not be aggressive with each other. But we want a moderate Islamic government that doesn't force us to wear hijab or force things on us, but gives us the choice.
The Ba'athists implemented reforms breaking away from Islamic traditions through the Iraqi Women's Federation. Each province had representatives who investigated cases of abuse against women and lobbied for a gender-sensitive interpretation of national laws. But the state apparatus was run by men, and senior management positions were only filled by men, as Iraq remained a largely patriarchal society. The Americans dissolved the federation, and a new, rather disorganized, Iraqi Women's Union is forming. They're planning a conference for July. Meanwhile, the High Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq seeks to establish a women's committee separate from U.S.-led coalition forces. The most important issue for women, whether secular or Islamist, is safety. The fear of abductions and harassment is keeping women in the house and distant from public debate. But for Sahar Jalil Muhammad, a 38-year-old divorcee with two small children, no matter what type of government fills Hussein's place, women will not be considered equal in this country. She has custody of her children under Ba'athist laws, but in Iraq, being divorced is shameful.
I want to run away from my life. Our social behavior is not like you. Here in Iraq, it's very difficult.
She says the only way she will obtain her rights is to live in the West. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Baghdad.
In Houston today, a woman suspected of leading the immigrant smuggling ring, which made national headlines when 19 immigrants were found dead and abandoned in the back of a commercial truck, was arrested. Since the tragedy, immigrants' rights organizations have stepped up the call to protect immigrants. On Saturday, a coalition of labor, religious community, and immigrants' rights organizations kicked off Houston's mobilization plans for the Immigrant Workers' Freedom Ride. part of a national effort to build widespread support for reforms to current immigration laws. Shannon Young files this report from Houston, Texas.
The Reverend Dr. Joseph Lowry co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with Martin Luther King Jr. On Saturday, he helped kick off the new Freedom Rides.
We get kicked down, we get pushed down, but by faith in God and our coming together in a coalition of conscience for a new era of activism, we can get up. Martin Luther King said injustice anyway is a threat to justice everywhere. Injustice to immigrant workers today is a threat to justice for all of us tomorrow.
While the route of the Houston bus is historically significant, buses will be traveling from all over the country, including Los Angeles, Miami, Chicago, and Boston. All will converge on Washington, D.C. in early October, and then proceed on to the Statue of Liberty in New York. A central aim of the Freedom Ride is to encourage immigrants working and living within the United States to regularize their status and to participate in the political process. U.S. Congressman Luis Gutierrez insists that an empowered Latino voter populace is key to effecting change in the makeup of legal representatives.
Uncertainty and fear and ignorance about immigrants have a history as old as our nation. Boston and Philadelphia papers in the mid-1900s century editorialized against the Irish, who they said were ruining our nation for the real Americans, those that come from England. It is not new or unusual for the real Americans, meaning those immigrants who came to America a little bit longer than us, to fear the outsiders, the pretenders, and the new Americans. We should be used to it. Italians and Italian immigrants and Italian Americans prevailed by organizing, by knocking on doors, by voting, by electing their own leaders of Italian descent. Yeah.
In addition to co-sponsoring the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, the Harris County AFL-CIO is organizing locally through campaigns like the Justice Bus, which will ride around Houston on Wednesday to distribute No Justice Here awards to businesses with grievous labor abuses. This is the fifth year of the Justice Bus Mobile Awards Ceremony. In addition to big business, this year an elected representative will receive a No Justice Award. While these awards are one way for workers to express their frustration with elected officials, Congressman Gutierrez thinks that voting is the most effective way to participate in the political system. He cites the example of California over the past decade. After the anti-immigrant Proposition 187 was passed, over 1.5 million Mexican permanent residents became citizens, registered to vote, and subsequently removed Pete Wilson from office. Still, Maria Jimenez, a national organizer of the Freedom Ride, points out that while discrimination based on race or gender is generally frowned upon, discrimination based on national origin continues to be a widespread practice. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Young in Houston.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Amma Boadi.